You know that feeling when you check your phone in the morning? Maybe you're just sitting there sipping your coffee, and there's that polite, incredibly corporate email waiting for you in your inbox.
Oh, yeah. The subject line is always something super vague, like an important update about your account.
Right. Exactly.
But it's never actually an update. I mean, it's always an app breakup letter. It's like, we are writing to share some difficult news. As of next month, we will be sunsetting our services.
Sunsetting. That word. It is literally the official death notice for your favorite tracking app. And for you, the listener, you know, the person who has poured hours, maybe years of your life into this platform.
Yeah, categorizing every single coffee purchase.
Logging every workout, tagging every crypto trade. It is just infuriating. You wake up and suddenly this meticulously curated digital history of yours is just gone.
Or worse, the company tells you they are pivoting and your data is now locked behind this sudden, massive enterprise paywall.
It's a uniquely modern kind of heartbreak.
It really is.
And it happens with such alarming regularity that we've like almost come to expect it. We sign up for these tools knowing on some level that the clock is already ticking on their demise.
Yeah, we're basically waiting for the inevitable.
So today, our mission on this deep dive is figuring out the mechanics of that ticking clock. Why is every personal tracking app you have ever loved eventually shut down, get sold, or just betray your trust?
It's a great question, and to answer it, we are pulling from a fascinating, honestly, brutally honest manifesto titled The Integration Tax.
Right, written by Vlad Salishikyu.
Yes, and published on localghost.ai. This document is this rare, unfiltered look under the hood of the software industry. We're going to explore the hidden economic forces that make these app shutdowns totally inevitable.
And then we're going to look at a radical AI-assisted solution to finally own your digital history. Okay, let's unpack this because we need to start with the core structural reality that drives this entire cycle.
Yeah, so the overarching theme here is that the villain isn't necessarily, greedy founders.
Oh, really?
No, the villain is this structural economic reality that the author calls the integration tax. And to understand how this tax operates, we kind of have to look at the author's own background.
Right. He built a tracker, didn't he?
He did. Vlad actually built a crypto portfolio tracker for a company called CryptoCompare. And by 2017, this tracker had hit 1 million monthly active users.
Wow, 1 million.
Yeah, which is massive scale for a personal dashboard. But here is the crazy part. He intentionally kept the tracker as manual input only for 9 straight years.
9 years of users physically typing in their holdings. I mean, no auto-syncing, no connecting directly to your bank or your Coinbase account.
Nothing, all manual.
From a user perspective, that feels like a glaring product flaw. Like you just assume the developers haven't gotten around to building the integrations yet.
Right. But he explains that the moment you start connecting automatically to exchanges or banks or fitness devices, you trigger this integration tax.
Because the digital world just refuses to stay still.
Exactly. Banks constantly change their OAuth flows or their export formats. APIs break or they get deprecated with, like, a month's notice.
Security protocols tighten up.
Yeah. Or a health data vendor might suddenly decide to just change the schema they use to log your REM sleep.
It honestly reminds me of trying to build a house on shifting tectonic plates.
Oh, I like that.
You can't just pour the foundation, frame the walls, and walk away. You have to employ a full-time, highly paid crew to literally live in the basement, perpetually patching the concrete and realigning the plumbing every single day just to keep the house from collapsing.
What's fascinating here is the harsh economics of that reality. Because the author notes that building your first 5 app integrations might take an engineering team a month.
Sure, that sounds reasonable.
But building and maintaining 100 integrations, that requires dedicating an entire engineering department strictly to maintenance.
Just to keep things from breaking.
Right. And the tax is paid in engineering salaries. And it never, ever stops. So, a personal tracker can only survive if the subscription fee you pay exceeds this perpetual rolling cost of maintenance.
And history shows us a very clear trend there. Users simply do not pay enough to cover that tax.
They don't. And beyond the engineering cost, there's also the legal burden.
Oh, right, the legal side.
Yeah, the author mentions that if they had automated that CryptoCompare tracker, the data actually transforms. It goes from being a casual virtual portfolio that a user just manually typed in to a cryptographically verified ledger of actual wealth.
Which changes the entire risk profile of the company.
Completely. Suddenly you are holding a verified picture of 1 million users' real financial assets.
Yikes.
That puts the company on the receiving end of tax authority subpoenas and source of funds requests every single quarter.
It transforms a simple software tool into a major compliance target.
Exactly. And frankly, it makes the data incredibly tempting to monetize. The author admits that if they held that verified data, they would be one stressful board meeting away from finding ways to sell it just to cover server costs.
Wow.
So keeping the product manual was literally the only way to protect the users, even if it meant the platform felt technically stagnant.
I kept the portfolio alive while refusing to make it useful. That line from the source material is such a striking paradox.
It really is.
But what about the founders who refuse to accept that paradox? The ones who decide to swallow the cost, build the auto-syncing tools, and try to pay the integration tax anyway?
Well, we need to look at what happens to those companies because the manifesto lays out a historical body count that spans 40 years.
A literal graveyard of good intentions.
Yeah, it's an ecosystem where the life expectancy of a startup is entirely dictated by how fast banks change their passwords. Let's look at Wasabi, for example.
Oh, I remember Wasabi. Founded in 2006, right?
Right. They launched 10 months before Mint. They were actually the first personal finance tracker to attempt automatic transaction aggregation.
But Wasabi cared deeply about user privacy.
Yes. So they refused to use third-party data aggregators. Instead, they built and maintained their own web scrapers to pull data directly from banks.
Which meant Wasabi's engineers were entirely consumed by the integration tax.
Completely.
Every time a bank redesigned its homepage, Wasabi's scrapers broke and their engineers had to drop everything to fix it.
And then Mint comes along. And instead of building scrapers, they outsource the tax entirely.
They hire Yodlee.
Exactly. Yeah. Yodlee, this massive third-party infrastructure company, handles the connections. So Mint's engineers get to focus entirely on building a beautiful UI with, you know, pie charts and instant gratification.
And Mint wins the market share battle, Wasabi runs out of money, and they shut down completely by 2010.
But look at the long-term trajectory of Mint.
Right.
They won the battle, hit 20 million active users, and sold to Intuit for $170 million. But outsourcing the integration tax to Yodlee wasn't free.
No, Intuit still had to pay those massive recurring API fees.
So they squeezed the Mint user base for affiliate leads for years, and eventually the math just stopped making sense. In 2024, Intuit shut Mint down and shoved all its users over to Credit Karma.
Which is essentially just a lending marketplace. It's not a budgeting tool.
Exactly. And we see this exact same failure cascade internationally. Like, in the UK, Money Dashboard was the largest personal finance manager.
And they sold to ClearScore.
Right. And by late 2023, ClearScore shut the consumer app down. Their official closure statement essentially admitted they could not find a sustainable business model to justify the maintenance costs.
And then there's Quicken.
Oh, Quicken. Founded in 1983, the oldest of them all.
But they only survive by holding users captive in proprietary formats and charging mandatory subscriptions after being bounced around between private equity firms.
Which brings into focus the three paths the author identifies for any company trying to survive this environment. If you were building one of these apps, you basically have three options to cover your engineering burn rate.
Okay, lay them out for me.
Path one is high churn subscriptions. You charge a monthly fee, but the perceived value of a budgeting app drops significantly after the first 3 months.
Because once a user realizes they spend way too much on takeout, looking at the dashboard just becomes depressing.
Exactly. They cancel. The churn kills the business before the integrations can even stabilize.
Oh, it's path two.
Path two is selling the user out. You give up on charging the user directly and you monetize their telemetry instead.
Like selling anonymized transaction feeds to hedge funds so they can track retail trends in real time.
Or selling health and fitness metrics to data brokers who funnel it to insurers. Or selling behavioral signals to ad networks.
Okay, and path three.
Path three is hidden affiliate fees. The app is completely free, but the advice it gives you quietly bends around what earns the company a commission.
So the dashboard might recommend a specific credit card or a lending partnership, not because it mathematically benefits its budget, but because that specific bank pays the highest acquisition bounty.
Yes. Personal Capital is a prime example of this. They gave away a phenomenal free dashboard, but its primary function was serving as a lead magnet to acquire high net worth customers for a wealth management firm.
Which eventually bought them out for $1 billion.
Right.
But wait, I'm struggling to accept that these are the only three options. What about a fourth path? What if a company is just, you know, honest?
Honest how?
Like, if you need $20 a month from every user to pay the engineering crew and keep the integration stable, just charge $20. Be transparent about the costs. Surely there is a segment of the market that would pay a premium for an honest product.
I mean, the honest product has been built dozens of times, but it rarely survives contact with the broader market.
Really? Why not?
Because an honest app charging $20 a month immediately gets undercut by a competitor who is secretly running path 2 or 3.
Ah, the one selling data or hiding affiliate fees.
Exactly. And offering their app for free. The average consumer, who is totally unaware of the hidden data harvesting, will almost always choose the free app.
So the honest product just gets starved of user acquisition.
Yeah. And eventually, the founders panic and either pivot to selling data themselves or they shut down.
Though the source material does point out one wild exception to this rule, right? CoinTracker.
Oh, yes. CoinTracker.
They reached a $1.3 billion valuation as a consumer crypto tracker. But they only achieved that because of the IRS.
Right. The IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2024-28.
Which essentially made automated per-wallet crypto tax tracking a legal requirement for anyone actively trading.
So CoinTracker survives because the government functionally forces people to buy that specific software to avoid an audit.
And even with that massive legally mandated advantage, the manifesto notes CoinTracker hasn't raised money in 4 years. The underlying tax is still eating at their margins.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to look at the companies that sit beneath these apps. If the consumer-facing dashboards are failing, who is actually making money?
Because someone is, right?
Yes, and the answer lies in the infrastructure layer. The manifesto highlights two massive entities, Yodlee and Plaid.
Right. Yodlee was the original backbone that powered Mint and Money dashboard. They sold for $660 million to InvestNet and are now basically being traded around by private equity firms.
And Plaid is the modern equivalent. Plaid built the modern software bridges to the banks, and they grew so dominant that Visa tried to buy them for $5.3 billion.
A deal the Department of Justice blocked due to antitrust concerns, just to be clear on the history there.
Yes. Impartially speaking, that is what happened. And today, Plaid holds a $13.4 billion valuation.
That's huge.
It is. But notice where Plaid and Yodlee focused their business today. They realized early on that consumer apps don't generate enough revenue to sustain the ecosystem.
So they pivoted.
They pivoted entirely to B2B. They took the infrastructure they built and started selling enterprise APIs directly to banks, lenders, and massive fintech corporations.
So the underlying infrastructure completely abandoned the everyday consumer.
Completely. The plumbing is highly valuable, but only when it's used to underwrite loans or verify identities for massive institutions, not for helping individuals track their grocery budgets.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, who just wants to track your net worth or your running mileage? When a startup fails or the infrastructure pivots to enterprise clients, what is actually lost?
Well, the manifesto introduces this concept of the interpretation layer, and this is where the cycle gets incredibly frustrating for the user.
It's a tragedy of context, isn't it?
Exactly. The raw numbers usually survive. The fact that an ACH transfer cleared or that you spent $4 at a coffee shop on a Tuesday, that raw transaction data lives safely in your bank's mainframe.
But the context around it.
Right. The custom rules you built to isolate your small business expenses from your personal ones.
Yeah.
The saving goals you meticulously adjusted over 3 years.
Or the careful tagging of your sleep data to correlate with your resting heart rate.
That is the interpretation layer.
You created that layer. It is a digital reflection of your habits and priorities.
Yeah.
But it only exists in the database of the dead company.
Yep. When Mint shut down and moved everyone to Credit Karma, the raw net worth numbers transferred over. But the custom budgeting categories.
Gone.
The historical transaction rules vanished.
Think about the hours you have spent tweaking a dashboard, completely at the mercy of a startup's runway clock. It's maddening.
The author's ultimate conclusion is that this failure is structural. If having a company sitting between you and your data guarantees failure, whether because of the integration tax, the temptation to sell data, or the pivot to enterprise clients, then the only way to win the game is to remove the company entirely.
The architecture itself has to change. Which brings us to local-first architecture. Instead of your data living on someone else's server in the cloud, it lives locally on your own physical hardware.
The manifesto highlights a project called Rotkey, built by a developer named Lefteris. It's an open source, local hardware, crypto portfolio tracker.
So all the categorizations, all the API keys, the entire database stays on the user's machine.
Yes. And Rodicky proves the architecture works. But as the text notes, it really struggles with mass consumer adoption.
Because it is competing with heavily funded, venture-backed cloud companies that can afford to subsidize a sleek, frictionless user experience.
Right up until the moment they run out of money.
Yeah. For the average user, the immediate convenience of a cloud app usually overrides the abstract security of self-hosting.
So we are stuck in this loop. Cloud apps are structurally doomed, but local first is historically too high friction for most people.
And this is where the author introduces his own project, Tallied.
Yes, Tallied. He describes it as a demon running quietly in the background of your computer.
And the scope of Tallied is staggering. It is designed to hold a lifetime of your data. Finances, heart rate, sleep stages, coding commits, weight, habits, all of it.
Now, from a purely technical standpoint, storing a lifetime of personal data is actually trivial.
Trivial, really?
Yeah, the author points out that 50 to 100 entries a day sustained across 40 years results in roughly a million rows of data.
Okay, a million rows.
And a standard Postgres database running on a cheap laptop can query a million rows in milliseconds. The storage engineering has existed for decades.
So what's the holdup?
What hasn't existed is the tooling to reliably pull all that disparate data into one place without triggering the integration tax.
Right. That is the exact hurdle. How does Tally beat the tax? I mean, if it's tracking everything from my checking account to my Garmin watch, doesn't it still need to constantly patch those API connections?
You think so?
Doesn't it still need an engineering department to fix the scrapers every time a bank updates its website?
This is where the technological landscape has fundamentally shifted in the last 2 years. The integration tax doesn't disappear, but AI radically changes the unit economics of paying it.
Oh, AI.
Yeah. In the legacy model, writing a custom parser, which is the code that translates a bank's messy proprietary CSV export into a clean database entry, required an engineer to write brittle, specific rules.
So if the bank changed a colon header from date to posting date, the parser broke, the sync failed, and an engineer had to manually debug and deploy a fix.
Exactly. But with AI tooling, the author explains that a process that used to take weeks of human labor now takes hours.
An LLM agent can just look at the raw, updated CSV from the bank, semantically understand that post-update means the same thing as the database's date column, and instantly map the data to the correct schema.
The AI essentially self-heals the parser. One person, utilizing these tools, can maintain the connections that used to require a whole department.
That is wild.
Furthermore, Tallied leans heavily into open standards to prevent data lock-in.
Yeah.
The text emphasizes OFX, which stands for Open Financial Exchange.
Which is a robust standard created back in 1997 by Microsoft and Intuit. It covers holdings, transactions, tax lots, everything.
Yet modern consumer tracking apps actively ignore it.
Because they rarely allow you to export your historical data in OFX format. They want to enforce captivity within their ecosystem.
Right. Tallied, by design, exports everything to OFX, CSV, and JSON on day one.
You know, relying on legacy cloud trackers is honestly like renting a diary from a landlord. The landlord holds the only key, reads the entries while you're asleep to sell you targeted ads, and has the legal right to throw the diary in an incinerator if the property stops being profitable.
That's a great analogy.
Local first architecture, like Tallied, is like buying the leather, binding the diary yourself, and keeping it securely on your own nightstand.
It summarized the harsh truths we've uncovered in this manifesto. The integration tax is an unavoidable reality of the digital world. Maintaining connections to disparate data sources is a perpetual massive expense.
Yep.
Because users will not pay the true premium required to cover that tax, corporate personal trackers are mathematically destined to do one of three things. They will run out of money and die, they will harvest your data to survive, or they will trap you in a walled garden to extract affiliate fees.
The era of trusting a venture-backed startup to safeguard your life's telemetry is ending. True ownership of your digital history requires a fundamental shift to an architecture where there is no corporate entity sitting between you and your own memories.
Because Tallied is open source and local, even if the author abandons the project tomorrow, your data survives.
The parsers live on GitHub. There is literally no company to fail.
But having a system like Tallied, a system fully capable of storing and parsing every metric of your existence locally, this raises an important question. The author leaves us with a profound philosophical dilemma at the very end of his manifesto.
It is a massive shift in perspective.
Vlad mentions his past work in the crypto industry, where he built systems that reduced a complex, chaotic basket of financial assets into a single tradable index number.
Which is difficult math, but it was just math.
Khalid, however, proposes something entirely different. It proposes gathering the inputs of a human being, a year of your sleep cycles, your shifting moods, your financial decisions, your health, your weight, your productivity habits.
If you have all of that data perfectly structured on your own machine, with a local AI capable of interpreting it, you could theoretically reduce your entire human life to a single metric.
An index number.
An index number that fluctuates daily, telling you exactly how efficiently you are performing at living.
The technical challenge of achieving that is functionally solved. The data can be acquired locally, the AI models are capable of the analysis, but the author asks a lingering question.
Is it morally right?
Should a human being ever be reduced to a single algorithmic number? Does the fact that you are the one doing it to yourself entirely privately on your own hardware make it any less dystopian?
It completely flips the script. We started this deep dive frustrated that corporate entities were taking our data away from us. But if we finally win that battle, if we bind our own diary, keep it on the nightstand, and point an AI at it, what happens when that diary starts grading us on our humanity? That is something you are going to have to mull over on your own. Until next time.